Good evening to each of you, and welcome to this particular service in our series of studies that will be going on this week. We're glad that you could be here tonight, especially glad for those who are able to be visiting with us from other places. It is a wonderful treat to be able to be doing the Lord's work, but in addition to the importance of that work, have the pleasure of meeting so many folks who love the Lord and who are busy in His work. I can't imagine a person being able to do anything that I enjoy any more than the work that I have the privilege of doing. It is just such a joy to get to associate with folks like you and to meet people who love the same things that you do and have the same values and are doing the same work, and just people that you've never met before. But how reassuring it is to know that the Lord has people in so many places soldiering on and doing what needs to be done. That's encouraging to me. I get to the end of this meeting, I'd be very doubtful if you will have gotten as much out of it as I have. I am indebted to you already for how refreshing and encouraging you've been to me. We're talking about a passage of Scripture in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, which talks about seeking God diligently. And that's a verse that many of us have been familiar with for a long time. It says that without faith it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. A right relationship with God is not something that happens by accident. It's not just a haphazard kind of a thing where you wake up one morning and discover that you have entered into a deep, rich relationship with God. It takes seeking Him and seeking Him diligently. And so we need, as time goes by, to learn how to make more careful decisions about God. And I hope that I will be determined to do that as a result of our studies together, and hope that you will too. In our last lesson this morning, we talked about believing that God is. And so tonight we want to go to the end of the verse and think about that idea of seeking God. God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. What would you say that means? And why is it necessary to seek God? I want us to think about that in the context of seeing a need that we have to have a deeper desire for God. And God is surely not just one of the important things in life. He is the highest of the higher things that we could be concerned about in this world. All people in the world are concerned about something. There's just not anybody that doesn't have some list of things that they consider to be very important. And what the business of life consists of is learning how to put the right emphasis in the right places, and to give our best attention to the best things in life. And so we're going to think about that tonight in terms of seeking God. The idea of seeking God really is an idea that has come to be quite popular in our day. You could go to the bookstore and find a number of books that talk about that concept of seeking God. And you may be aware that it's kind of a trend in denominational church circles for some churches even to have separate services on Sunday morning, which they'll call seeker services. And that'll be a different kind of a service than their regular traditional worship for their members. They'll have a separate service that they try to orient toward people who are seeking God. So you'll hear a lot of people talking about seeking God these days. But I'm afraid that much that is called seeking God in our day is not really about God. When you begin to talk to people about what they mean by seeking God, you find out that that is more an exercise in self-gratification. They are looking for a God that's the kind of God they want to exist, and a God whose will is consistent with what they think God's will ought to be, a God that would fit their lifestyle, and that's what they're seeking, for reasons really that amount to very selfish or self-centered reasons. So I want us to think about what will be involved in truly seeking the God who really does exist, whether he turns out to be the God that we would want to exist or that we would prefer to exist. First of all, let's think about some things that seeking God is not. And before I put the list up in front of you, I want to say right up front that these things we're about to talk about are very, very important. And I'm not trying to diminish from the importance of these things. I simply want to think about these things as things that are related to seeking God. They are connected to seeking God, but they in and of themselves would not constitute seeking God. As I told you this morning, down in Indiana, we have the technology to put those points up individually. I know you're a little bit backward up here in the Northeast. So there are all the points. But just think about the first one with me. Church membership and even faithful church attendance by itself wouldn't constitute seeking God, would it? There might be all kind of reasons why people would come to church. They may come, as we talked about this morning, because they were taught that that would be a habit in your life. And that's just what you do. People may come because they're afraid of what the consequences would be if they didn't. They'd be withdrawn from. Or just a lot of reasons why people might want to be a member of a church and attend the services faithfully. And you can't pay serious attention to the Lord without paying serious attention to that together. Part of Christianity, that's very important. But don't think that just because you're a member of a faithful congregation and you attend the services of that church on a fairly regular basis, that automatically means you are seeking God. It may or may not be, depending on what else is going on in your life. Bible study by itself wouldn't constitute seeking God, because you might be studying the Bible for a lot of reasons other than seeking God. I studied under a professor when I was doing graduate work, who was one of the deepest New Testament scholars that I have ever personally known. He had been studying the New Testament longer than I've been in the world, and knew, at least from a technical standpoint, a lot more about what was here than I did. But he was an atheist. He did not believe in the God of the New Testament. He studied this as an ancient document. He was a scholar in an ancient document, and quite a technical expert in it. So he searched the scriptures in a certain sense, but it wasn't about God for him. It was a scholarly endeavor. Doctrinal soundness by itself wouldn't mean that you're seeking God, because it might be a lot of reasons why you would think that that was important. Personal evangelism. You might do that for reasons that have more to do with you or the local church or whatever, that wouldn't by itself mean that you are a seeker of God. Not even if you had a serious prayer life, not even a serious devotional discipline in your daily living, would that by itself mean that you're seeking God. I know a lot of people who, if our understanding of the New Testament is correct, are not even in fellowship with God, who have a more serious daily devotional life than some of us do. But they're not seeking God, or if they are, they've certainly not even yet found out what it takes to become a New Testament Christian, but they're people of prayer and would have devotional time in their lives. Spiritual feelings by themselves, of course, don't make you a seeker of God, because you can manufacture spiritual feelings in a lot of ways, can't you? By turning the lights down and playing certain kinds of music and all of those kinds of things. Not even, and you might find this hard to believe, not even a love for the truth itself would mean that you are a seeker of God. What Jesus said in John 7, verse 17 is that he who wills to do the will of the Father, he shall know whether the teaching is from heaven or from men. On an intellectual level, you might be very interested in getting correct answers to questions from this book, but if that's about you rather than about God, then you're not seeking him. Now, remember what I said at the top of that list. Not trying to diminish the importance of these things. Everything on that list, I believe, to be very important. And in another sermon, I might be emphasizing the importance of one or more of those things. But I put that list before you so that you can look at that and see where you are in terms of all of these things. And if you rated highly in all of those areas, don't breathe a sigh of relief and say, well, then I don't need to hear this lesson. I'm a seeker of God. You can do all of those things for various reasons and it not be about God. And just to throw in promotional announcement for the lesson Wednesday night. The lesson Wednesday night will end this series by talking about what our motivation is and what our reasons ought to be for seeking God. But that is not what seeking God is. Well, what is it? If you had to define seeking God, how would you define it? I would say, and this comes from several passages, that looking at it all together seems to me to get pretty close to the heart of the matter. Seeking God would be growth and obedience with a desire to love and honor God and to be doing that more each day. It's kind of the idea of reaching out toward God because we want to be closer to Him. But what we're wanting to do is to do a better job of being what He wants us to be, and that's what obedience is. Want to do and be what He wants us to be, but to do that for the reason that we really desire both to love and honor Him, and we're wanting more and more of that every day. We're not content with where we are today in those areas. You could say it in different ways, couldn't you? What we're talking about here is learning to have a deeper longing to be closer to God than we are right now. I well remember when I was in the second grade, falling in love with a pretty little girl who was also in the second grade of the school that I attended. I don't recall at this point what her name was, but I can vividly conjure up in my mind the image of how pretty she was. She had a ponytail, and she wasn't in my class. She was in the other second grade class, but I would see her on the playground, and she was just to me a vision of beauty. And for about 2 weeks, you know, which is about as long as these things last in the second grade, she's all I thought about. I mean, I thought about her in class when I was supposed to be studying arithmetic. I thought about her at recess when I could see her across the playground. I thought about her when I went home at night, in the afternoon, and I thought about her when I was trying to sleep at night. I desired to be closer to her than I was across the playground, and I, in my little infantile mind, manufactured every kind of technique I could imagine to narrow the gap. Didn't do it. She wouldn't give me the time of day when I made advances toward her, but boy, I wanted to narrow the gap. And I thought about it. I dreamed about it. I desired it. I did everything I knew to do to be closer to that other human being. Well, on a very small level, something like that ought to be going on with regard to us and God. There's obviously a gap between us and Him. And even if you have obeyed the gospel of Christ and are in fellowship with God, there's still a gap, isn't there? As long as we live in this world, we're not in immediate face-to-face fellowship with Him. And so, even as Christians, we're wanting to be closer to God than we are right now. And it's not just a slight thing with us, is it? It's something that we deeply desire. It's a goal that we reach out for, as Paul said in Philippians chapter 3 and verse 13, when he talked about forgetting the things that are behind and reaching forward, straining every fiber of our being toward that which is out ahead of us. There are a lot of other expressions in the Bible that talk about the same kind of thing. In the Old Testament, particularly in the Psalms, you read a lot about desiring God. For example, in Psalm 27 and verse 4, many of the Psalms that have a similar sentiment. The psalmist said, "One thing I have desired of the Lord, and that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in His temple." David had that attitude, didn't he? He had a deep desire to dwell in the house of the Lord. We might talk about it in terms of Matthew 22. Verses 37 and 38. When the Jews asked Jesus what he thought was the most important commandment in the law of Moses. Remember what he said? Just to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. And the second most important commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. Those are more than words. When we talk about seeking God, we're talking about trying to have a more wholehearted affection for Him. And I understand that the love that we're supposed to have for God is not just an emotion. It involves the will as well as the emotion, but it ought to involve the emotion as well. I think we maybe run to the other extreme of leaving the affectionate part out of it. Yes, it does involve the obedience of the will, but we ought to love God and to love Him wholeheartedly. It's not just to give Him one or two rooms in the house of our heart, but to throw open all the doors and let Him have access to the whole house. The Bible talks about calling upon the Lord, and that's simply another way of talking about the same thing. If you're still in Psalms, look over at Psalm 145, verse 18, which uses language it's quoted very often in the New Testament. The Lord is near to all who call upon Him, to all who call upon Him in truth. In the New Testament, to call upon the Lord means to appeal to Him for a clean conscience. As one seeks to obey the gospel, we call upon the Lord and we're willing to obey the conditions of the gospel, then He forgives us of our sins. But that idea of calling upon the Lord, I don't know about you, but that to me conveys the idea of a fervent appeal to God. We are calling out to Him for something that we know we desperately need. And again, it's that idea of realizing there's a gap between us and God. We were created to be close to God, but we're not close to Him, and we're wanting to be the very thing that we were created to be. That is to have fellowship with Him. Let me just say it this way. When we seek God, what we are seeking is essentially this, and that is to relate ourselves rightly to His glory. And I want you to think for just a second about a statement that Paul makes in Philippians, the first chapter, and verse 20, that I think really helps us to understand what it is to seek God and really what it is that we are seeking when we seek God. Paul, in writing in Philippians, of course, is writing from a prison cell in Rome. And he writes back to Philippi to express to them his appreciation for the help that they had sent to him while he was in Rome, and to encourage them. And as Paul wrote that, he didn't know how that was going to turn out. He had a trial coming up, and he didn't know but what he might be very shortly put to death for having preached the gospel of Christ. And so, if you had been in Paul's position, sitting in a Roman prison dungeon, contemplating the fact that you might be very shortly put to death, would you have had a preference, a personal preference about how that turned out? I expect most of us would. And I don't doubt at the personal level that Paul had a preference about that. But listen to what he says. Truly amazing attitude, I think. He talks about asking them to pray for him in his circumstance, and he said, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness, as always, now listen to it, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. And do you see what Paul is saying there? He's facing two possibilities. I might live, but I might be put to death for having preached the gospel. And Paul is praying about that, asking other people to pray for him on his behalf. But what does Paul want? Would you say Paul was a seeker of God? I would. If ever we read about a man in the New Testament who sought God, it was Paul. But what did seeking God mean for Paul at the practical level? All Paul wanted was for Christ to be magnified in his body. Whether that meant him being put to death or that meant him continuing to live really was immaterial as far as Paul was concerned. He wanted whatever would result in Christ being more greatly glorified. And for his part, Paul was willing to fulfill whatever the assignment might turn out to be. It wasn't about Paul. It was about God. And what Paul was seeking was God and God's glory and the furtherance of God's purposes and God's good pleasure. And Paul had a mature enough attitude as a Christian to simply say, what I desire is simply to be used of God in whatever way he may be able to make use of me, even if it is by my being put to death for the cause of the gospel, whatever will more greatly glorify Christ is what I want. Now, can you say that? You tell me you are seeking God. Is that what it comes down to in your life? Or, as in the case of too many of us, when we talk about seeking God, does it not turn out to be the case, when we really get honest, that what we are seeking is certain things that we want to get out of God that we think would be pretty good for us? Are we really seeking God, or are we seeking a particular path to God that we have in our mind? Are we seeking God, or are we seeking a certain set of circumstances within which we would like to serve God? Does it make any difference to you where you serve God geographically? Does it make any difference to you whether it's big congregation, little congregation, congregation that sings in tune or that can't sing in tune, or that has friendly people or unfriendly people, or rich people or poor people, or pleasant people or irritable people? Would you be willing to serve the Lord wherever He needed you for His glory? Or do you have some preferences about that that really are more important to you than what the Lord might need at a given time? When you became a Christian, did you have an idea in your mind about how it was going to go? What it would be like to be a Christian? Probably did. Most of us did. We may not have thought about it consciously, but we had some idea how this thing was going to go. And we were drawn to that. We wanted that, or we probably wouldn't have obeyed the gospel. But now let me ask you, what happens when it turns out differently than the way you thought it was going to go? What happens when the scenario turns out not to be real, that was just the way you thought it would turn out, but now the real path is a very different path than what you had in mind? Do you become unfaithful under those circumstances? If so, somebody might ask what you were really seeking in the first place. Was it God you were seeking, or a particular path to God that looked pretty good to you? If the path turned out to be something different that would still lead to God, if it was God you wanted, then that would be okay, wouldn't it? If we could say what Paul can say, we want Christ to be magnified, whether by our life or our death. I'll tell you, I worship with a small, struggling, aging congregation in Indianapolis, Indiana, in an area where there are lots of other congregations within easy driving distance. And it very frequently happens, and I hope I haven't just got irritable on this point, but it very frequently happens to us that we'll have somebody maybe move into the Indianapolis area, maybe even live in our part of town, and they will come and worship with us for a few services, and there'll be somebody who could just help us so much in the work of the Lord. But what we know is that before they decide where they're going to place membership, they're going to visit some other congregations, and once they do, we will never see them again. They want to go somewhere where there are, quote, more children their children's age, where there's a more extensive teaching program, and where certain external things are more like they want it to be as a Christian. And very rarely think in terms of what they could give. They're thinking, you know, what could we get here? If we can't get at Westside in Indiana, if it can't go here like we think it ought to go, if we had our choice, then we're out of here. And I've come to see, in areas where people have a choice of maybe a dozen congregations to pick from, many people, even some of whom we would consider to be the Lord's most faithful people, make their decision about where they're going to worship on essentially social basis. And are unwilling, seemingly, to live and serve in some area where God is just as much present, His work needs just as much to be done, but the circumstances are not like we want them to be. And I say that not to be critical of other people. I have some preferences about the kind of congregation I'd like to preach for. I have some preferences about how I'd like my life to go as a gospel preacher. And it takes just as much soul searching on my part to ask, okay, Gary, are you really seeking God at any cost, by any path? Is it Him you seek? Is what you want simply to be rightly related to His glory, whatever that means for you? Or is this about me? Well, don't want to steal my thunder from Wednesday night, and we'll talk about motivation, but you can see where we'll be headed in that lesson, can't you? Seeking God doesn't just mean seeking certain things that we would like to get from God. It has to be about Him. If it's not, then we really need to wonder what it is that we are interested in, what it is that we are trying to seek. Both my boys are violinists, and they played in a lot of orchestras, and a lot of orchestras at different levels of expertise. And both Brock and Grant were pretty skilled violinists, and in their school orchestras, both of them were usually able to be concert masters. Play first chair violin. They'd be the big guy, you know, that tunes the rest of the orchestra, and they have to follow him. They've occasionally had the honor of playing in some regional and state level honors orchestras, and with the competition more stiff, wouldn't always get to be concert master. And during those years, I'd have some very frank talks with my sons and say, guys, an orchestra is not a solo deal here. This is a collaborative effort. And if you enjoy music for the sake of music, it really won't matter whether you sit first chair violin or you sit in the back of the orchestra where nobody can even see you back there. What is this about? Is it about the activity or about what chair you prefer to sit in? God has an orchestra. Are you willing to play whatever part He has in mind for you? Would you be willing to be back there in the back of the percussion section, you know, playing the triangle? As well as if He said, no, I want you to come up front here and play first violin. If it's about Him, we'll be just delighted to be in the orchestra, wherever we may sit, whatever may be our role. Big, little, as people look at it, is immaterial. We want God to be glorified, and whatever He needs from me to accomplish His glory is what I ought to be seeking at whatever cost and whatever price. Why is that important? Why is it necessary to start with? Is God hard to find? No. Paul said in Acts chapter 17 when he was preaching in Athens that God has made us so that we will grope for Him and so that we might find Him, but it's not as though God is hard to find, for He is close to us at every minute. God has set this thing up so that we will have to seek Him, not because He's playing hide and seek with us, but because God wants to know who cares and who doesn't. God has designed the scheme of salvation such that it filters out people who really are not interested in seeking Him. I believe God put some obstacles in the path of us as we are making our way toward God to find out who's really serious about this thing and who isn't. I was thinking not too long ago about Jesus Himself. And when Jesus first publicly began to preach the coming of the kingdom, it was after He had come back from His 40 days in the wilderness. Now, we're all pretty well dressed here tonight. Most of us have had a fairly recent shower, and we've got cologne on, and we're fixed up pretty good. But can you imagine the shape Jesus was in when He came back from that 40 days in the wilderness? I don't know whether He was clean shaven before He went, but even if He was, He had a 5-week-old beard. His hair would have been greasy and matted to His head. He would have been gaunt, skin and bones from no food for 5 weeks. His body odor would have been offensive. There would have been nothing about Him physically that would have been appealing to anybody. In that condition, He steps forward and says, I am the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Who will follow me? Would you have followed a guy like that at that point? Been anything desirable about him from a worldly standpoint that would have said, yes, that's the King? No. Most of us wouldn't have even wanted to be in the same room with somebody like that, even today. Well, Jesus wanted to know then, just as he wants to know now, who's really interested in what he has, and who would just be interested in some outward things that would be superficial and that really don't matter. I think we need to be careful in our day. You know, there's a certain sense in which we want to put our best foot forward as we present ourselves to the community. It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing when we are so friendly and dressed so nicely and make such a good worldly impression upon people that they say, yes, that's a group of people I would really enjoy being with. I know some congregations that are so homogeneous, that is, they are so much clones of one another in terms of their social and their economic makeup. They are people who would enjoy being together whether they had the Lord in common or not. They're birds of a feather that would flock together. And you could take the Lord out of that picture and they'd be still people that enjoy doing, you know, getting together and eating like we did this afternoon and getting together in one another's homes and going to sporting events together. God wants to know who's interested in Him and who might just be interested in all that peripheral stuff. If you'd lived in the days of Jesus, there wouldn't have been anything about him, and there wouldn't have been anything about Paul. Or the other apostles that would have drawn you to them and said, yes, that's a wonderful group of people that I would like to be a part of. In fact, I seem to hear Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 saying that when he came to Corinth, he deliberately cut back on the eloquence that he might have demonstrated as a learned Jewish scholar. He deliberately was less impressive as a speaker than he might have been, lest they put their faith in that. So what about us today? I believe God will put some stumbling blocks in there. Some things that will filter out the people that really are interested in more what they can get out of this thing as opposed to those who really are seeking God. God wants to know those who diligently desire fellowship with Him. And let me tell you, that's a first principles issue. There are a lot of preachers calling for more first principles preaching, and that's true in a certain sense, but I think sometimes what we call first principles are not basic enough. If we're not seeking God, if that's not what we are hungering and thirsting for, then we can be taught the gospel plan of salvation and what the correct actions are by which one needs to obey the gospel, and we can go through those motions. If we haven't come to the point where we're seeking God, then we'll do no more than get wet when we're baptized. So the issue of seeking God needs to be hammered away on way before we get to the steps of what to do about that in terms of obeying the gospel. Have you noticed in the book of Acts that there is not a sermon in the book of Acts that explains anything about how to obey the gospel? Until you had some people asking, how do you obey the gospel? As on Pentecost. Peter preached his whole sermon and never talked about how to obey the gospel. Nobody would need to know how you do that until they had gotten to the point where they were longing for forgiveness and seeking God and saying, what should we do? Then you talk about how that's accomplished. But we spend most of our time talking about how to become a Christian and get a few people persuaded to do that. But if they're not seeking God, then we really haven't accomplished anything. So the question of seeking God is a lot more basic even than faith and repentance and confession and baptism. And we need to get more basic in our preaching. But when we do seek God, aren't there some wonderful promises in the Scriptures for those few who will truly seek? For example, Jeremiah chapter 29, beginning of verse 12. Jeremiah 29, verse 12, when It was explained to the people of Israel that they were going to be sent away into Babylonian captivity, and there would be a period of real hardship for 70 years. But God said to them, "Then you will call upon me and go and pray to me, and I will listen to you. And you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart." God promises that he will be found by those who will search for him with all of their hearts. So are we doing that? How about you? And how about me? Here are some questions, four questions, that I think will help you understand to what level, to what extent, you are seeking God. We talked in the beginning about the fact that Bible study by itself wouldn't constitute seeking God. But if you tell me that you are seeking God and you have no interest in studying this book, I'm going to say that you're not being honest with yourself. To seek God would mean that you would be hungry and thirsty for anything you could hear him say. And so the knowledge of God would be a high priority with you, if you're truly seeking that. Said, you might be studying this book for other reasons, and that wouldn't be seeking God. But if you are seeking him, then you're going to be in this book a lot of the time, because this will be like a love letter to you from the person you love the most, and you will just drink up every syllable of that information because you want God. And what about the will of God? If we're seeking God, won't we want to obey him? You don't need to tell me. But why don't you just ask yourself how you relate to the subject of obedience? Do you think of obeying God as something that you just... you might not really want to do it, but we've got to do it in order to go to heaven, so I guess we just have to tough it out. Well, if that's your attitude toward obedience, I'm doubtful that you're seeking God. A person who would seek God would delight to know and to do whatever God would want to be done, because it's God who's asking. And then what about worship? You can tell something about how diligently you are seeking God based upon how much you welcome worshiping God, not only with others of God's people like we're doing tonight, but even on a private daily basis in your everyday life. Is worship something you really enjoy doing, something that you're drawn to, something that you would like as much of as possible in your life? How could we possibly be seeking God and not thrill at the very idea of worshiping God all that we can? And finally, the people of God. We seek God, we will thoroughly enjoy being with his people, won't we? Even though in this life, all of the other people of the Lord that we'll have the privilege of being with will have some faults and some foibles, just like we do. It won't be a perfect group of people, and sometimes they will be frustrating. If we're seeking God, I believe we'll love to be with his people. In fact, if we're seeking God, one thing that we will seek will be to have the same set of friends and enemies that God has. I think one of the real problems that we have in this life is that we try to have more friends than God has. He has some enemies, but we want to be on good terms with those people who are God's enemies, and so we'll compromise the truth sometimes to try to have more friends than God does. God's friends are his people who are faithful to him, who are worshiping him, and we ought to desire to be with those people. I mentioned to you that our congregation back home is kind of an older, aging congregation, and the aging is not just, that's not the half of the story. We are an uneducated group of people. We have our share of illiteracy in the congregation and some mental retardation, and we're just kind of a ragtag group of people in a lot of ways. One of the most thrilling things that happened to me, has ever happened to me, happened a few Wednesday nights ago. We have a member who, I think he has at most an eighth grade education. And I'm not sure if he's playing with a full deck, even. He has some serious limitations in a lot of ways. 6 years ago, when I moved there, he was not regular in his attendance. We just constantly had to go visit him and try to impress upon him the importance of doing the Lord's will and all of that. And he had a drinking problem. I never will forget the first time I visited him in the hospital. He'd had some heart trouble, and the doctor had come in to talk to him and said, Mr. Gregory, you need to not drink and not smoke. And I expected him to say, well, I don't do any of those things. But his response was, well, I don't drink that much. So he had some serious issues in his life in terms of his relationship with the Lord. And he's made out of pretty rough material. But 2 weeks ago Wednesday night, when I got to the building, he met me at the front door. He said, Gary, you're on to do the Wednesday night invitation talk. But he said, would you let me do that tonight? He'd never stood in front of an audience in his life to make any kind of a talk. But he said, I've got something I really would like to talk about to the congregation tonight. And he stood up without any notes and just spoke from his heart about something that he felt was important for us to think about. And it was a beautiful thing. I have never heard a more eloquent sermon than that little talk from that man who spoke straight from his true heart about some things that he struggled with and wanted us all to understand that we're about helping one another in the Lord's work. And he just said some things that we all needed to hear. I had to hang my head in shame after that service and admit to myself, this is a fellow that at one level I don't enjoy spending very much time with. I spend more time with him than anybody else in the congregation. He calls me up and wants to take me out to eat lunch, and so I spend a significant amount of time with him. But he is not the kind of person that on my own I would select as one of my best friends. But I had to admit that night, that he's just one of the highest quality human beings I've ever met. Because in his limited way, he's seeking the Lord and doing all he knows to do about that. And he's one of the Lord's folks. And we need to love the Lord's folks, whether they're in our socioeconomic group or not, whether they are birds of our feather or not. If they are the Lord's people, and we are seeking Him, then we need to hug folks like that and let them know that we are honored to be connected to them in the Lord's work. You wouldn't have a hard time at Tingsboro loving the Lord's people here because you're easy to love. And I'm thrilled that it's that way. And I'm thrilled that you enjoy being together. That's exactly the way it ought to be. But what you ought to enjoy about this is that you have the Lord in common. And that ought to be what you enjoy about it the most. God is seeking those who are seeking Him. And that's a wonderful thought, isn't it? The very last book of the Old Testament, in Malachi chapter 3, we read about the Lord saying that in Malachi's day, that there weren't many who gave Him reverence or who were seeking Him. Chapter 3, verse 16 says, "Then those who did fear the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before Him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on His name." I like that thought a lot. Jesus has a special affection for those, however few they may be, who really are seeking Him. He wrote their names in His book of remembrance. Joshua Loth Liebman said, "God hears no sweeter music than the cracked chimes of the courageous human spirit ringing in imperfect acknowledgement of His perfect love." My chimes are cracked, aren't yours? When I try to express to Him how much I love Him, the words I can think to speak are nowhere near the kind of words that He deserves to hear. I take it based upon His faithful promises that brings joy to Him. When even in our broken, feeble way, we try to express to Him how much He means to us. H.G. Wells, and you might not have ever thought was a religious writer, said this, and it was true. He said, where there is faith, where there is need, there is the true God, ready to clasp the hands that stretch out seeking for him into the darkness behind the ivory and the gold. There aren't many people who are seeking God. Even among those who say that that's what they're doing, there aren't many who are really seeking God. And I'm afraid we need to ask ourselves the question, have we grown up in sound, faithful congregations and never really learned a real desire for God himself? That's a possibility, isn't it? I'm afraid it didn't become very real to me until just a few years ago. The Lord had a hard time getting my attention for real. But whatever our background is immaterial. The question is our desire for God himself? Religion is not only about serving God, it's about desiring him, loving him with all of our heart and our soul and our mind. So David said, we read it a while ago, one thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. We need to work on it being as important to us, simply to love God and be in fellowship with him and long for the day when our fellowship will not be broken and imperfect as it is in this life, but we'll be perfected into a face-to-face, sweet, eternal fellowship that will last forever. That's what life's about. That's what Christianity is about. Having a deeper desire for God every day. It's what the point of this whole thing is. I was working on a lesson just this afternoon, a series of lessons that I'm trying to put together that will coordinate with a new book that I'm trying to write and get finished by next year called Reaching Forward, based upon Philippians 3:13, where Paul said he was forgetting the things that were behind and was reaching forward to those things that are ahead. And he talked about the fact that he had not already attained the goal, he had not already been perfected, but he was reaching forward to what this whole thing is really about. And we need to ask ourselves some honest questions about what it is about as far as we are concerned. What are you in this for? What is this about as far as you're concerned? It ought to be about God. By any path, at whatever price, in any way that will glorify him. And may God help us to say a more honest yes to the question, are we seeking him? If you are here tonight and there's any way in which we can assist you in taking some actual steps that God would command you to take, to obey the gospel, or if you've obeyed the gospel in the past but you've become unfaithful to him, if there's steps that you need to take that we can assist you with, such as helping you to be baptized into Christ. And the invitation song is to provoke you to think and to decide that this is the night when you'll take care of the most important business that there ever could be in the world. We'd be honored to help you if you'd let us know of your desire while we stand and sing.